Bishop on December the 16th, 2006, interviewing Bob Hale. So, Mr. Hale, if you would just state for the recording your name and...
Robert Monroe Hale.
Okay. And he's being interviewed in the Harrison Museum. And when and where were you born?
I was born here in Roanoke, October 8, 1924, at 612 Harrison Avenue.
Okay. And how long have you lived in Gainesboro?
Well, I lived here until I went into the service, and then came back here, and then went to Boston in 1960.
And how long did you stay there?
27 years.
Okay, so you've been back...
about almost 20 years.
87 or so.
Yeah.
And so the streets, you repeat again the streets that you've lived on here in Roanoke.
Well, this is Harrison Avenue, 6th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And Patton Avenue, which is 5th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And, Roy Avenue, Southwest. And Atlanta Terrace. That's all I can think of now.
And tell me about your parents and your brothers and sisters.
My parents. Well, mother was a school teacher for several years at this school here. And...
her name?
Esther Tallahale. And my father, he worked at the freight station for years, but he became crippled, so he was invalid for a long time. And I think he died in 36. And
his name was
James Henry Hale. Mm-hmm. And I have a brother who's a junior, James Henry Hale Jr. He's in Hampton. He's a retired teacher. And there is the next brother, Nathaniel Hale, Bay Hale. He's deceased since 01, I think it was. And there's a sister, Esther Antoinette Hale. She was much named after mother. And who is that Hale? That's it. I think so far as the immediate family.
And did you have extended family members living nearby?
You mean cousins?
When you were growing up.
Cousins in charge? Oh, yeah, a whole bunch of them.
Uncle.
Yeah, a whole bunch of them. I don't know what you want me to. Uncle Bob and Uncle Harrison, and it's just a bunch of them. I think Granddad had about 10 children, you know. I think 5 girls and 5 boys. So we had lots of aunts and uncles and cousins, and, you know, the Hales just took over one of them.
How about your mother's side? Were her people here too?
They were from Richmond, and grandmother lived in Richmond. She lived 100, almost 101. And mother lived to 94, and, her people, well, they were scattered about New Jersey and in the country, down in the country somewhere, outside of Richmond. And, they just all scattered about. It's hard to keep up with. But most of them were in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so.
And describe that the house at 612 Harrison Avenue, what it looked like.
Well, it's still there now. But it was double. In fact, I think we lived upstairs. Because I think my aunt and granddad lived downstairs. So it was pretty crowded up there at times. Because, you know, with four people, with almost 6 people, so to speak, the daddy died. So, so we had to upstairs. And, during those days, it was, just rooms heated individually, you know. But we had to heat water to take a bath and stuff like that. And, but it was, you know, everybody went to school, didn't have far to go to school. We just walked down the street, you know. And, you just never really thought about, you know, being poor, but you were poor. And because mother, she worked in Bridgeport, Connecticut during the summer, because that's when the school was out. And worked for some people up in Bridgeport. And leave us here with the aunts and uncles. And because daddy wasn't able to work. But that's, you know, a long time ago that you thought about these things. But we could, I had a paper route over on 7th. And I think my brother had one too. And we basically just was a tight, even because all the relatives, you know, the Scots and all the people lived on the street. You had a neighborhood. So we really, everybody was more of a family, you know, because everybody knew each other. From the school teachers knew you, and they were part of the church you went to, and, you know, it was more of a community. But the boys went to Hampton, and the sister went to Virginia State, I think. And it must be, is it university now? Yeah, all of them are. And I think they had some cousins who went to Bluefield State. And that was always the exciting thing, you know, coming home for Christmas, you know. And what were they, 20 years old or something like that? But you would look forward to them coming home for Christmas. And sending packages, you know, food packages, stuff like that. So then the draft, the army came, the World War II. And so a lot of people got scattered, you know, during that time. Sort of regrouped a little bit when they came home. In 46, so much going on.
Any other activities that you all participated in, church or clubs or anything that you all did?
Oh, well, you went to church. Everybody went to church. And
where did you go?
We went to Mount Zion, AME, which is now Melrose. But we, you know, it was during the, you just had to make your own fun. There was no computers and cell phones and TV and stuff like that. So you were a little more creative, I believe. You know, flying kites and shooting marbles. And we were quite musical, too, because Mama had this old upright piano. So we all learned to play just by ear. And, because I think she played, too, because she worked at the Y for a long time with kids. So it was mostly musical, guitar, ukuleles then, and guitars. And I think somebody, it was a violin, but we didn't go for that. And it was mostly, I just learned the piano, you know, at home. But, my brother played trumpet, I think. And my sister, you know, took music classes, too. So basically it was, you think about it, the whole family was musical. Then we got into photography, you know, taking pictures with the little brownie cameras.
Oh.
So it was the time of you just had to do your thing. You didn't have, you know, we got little erector sets and chemical sets for Christmas, and wagons and stuff like that. But no Nintendos. And, you know, it didn't cost that much either. It's a long time ago. We used to get the Christmas tree on, man, you see our Christmas tree on the corner.
Uh-huh.
And they were, what, 35 cents or 50 cents. And then we'd wait until he sold all his clothes and go home. We'd go down and pick up the ones that was there, which was pretty scrawny. But you fix the tree up, you know, and Mama provided for us. She took care of the family, and she worked and provided for us. So that was a, you know, basically a single parent at that time, because daddy was really in the wheelchair. He couldn't get around. So she took care of everybody. And then we had family, too. The aunts were downstairs. The aunts were up the street. The uncles, Uncle Bob had the Dreamland, and he had a grocery store. And he has Pine Oaks now. There's a street named after Hale up there. And I don't know who must be stealing that. But that's, you know, it might seem like a dull life to some kids nowadays, but nobody had a car, you know, and just you walked everywhere you went. And so you really just was living in an era that wasn't quite as advanced as it is now.
What kind of work did your mother do?
She was a school teacher. She taught here first or second grade, and then the substitute once for fourth grade or something.
Here at Harrison.
Yeah, here at Harrison.
Mm-hmm. And then she also taught at the Y?
Yeah, she taught, and then the summer she taught at the playground. You know, they used to have a lot of activities at the playground. All the swings and they had pet shows, and there was a lot of activities. People were just out then. You were outside then. Everything went on outside. And because even with the radio, it was about one station, you know. So everything really happened on the outside. A lot of activities, not outside playing, you know, ball games and stuff like that. But that's where she taught over from a long time over to the playground. And then she taught at the Y.
And what kind of work have you done throughout your life?
Not much. Well, when I came back from the Army, I worked at the city school board for a little while. Then that's when I went to Boston in 51 to study music for a couple of years and came back, and basically, what did happen? Where were we working? We were working somewhere. Well, maybe I was working for a school board then too. But I had a couple, we were playing music, you know, like that.
And where did you study music in Boston?
Well, first there was a little school called Phil Saltman School of Music.
What is it?
Phil Saltman.
Uh-huh.
It was a school of music. Then there was another one I went to, it's called Berkeley House. It was called Schillinger House, but the man who was the owner, his name was Burke, and his son's name was Lee. His name was Lawrence Burke's son. So that's how the Burke Lee School of Music came to be. And it was about 50 students here, and it's about 5,000 at least. Yeah, it's a college now. Yeah. But, so then I came home and started the family, and went back to school. Then went back to Boston actually in 60.
Well, what did you do then?
Then I did some more studying, and I went into photography like when I was there, and worked for the Boston redevelopment. Did a lot of work for them.
Photography?
Yeah, doing their photography work. Mm-hmm. And worked for a small black newspaper, something like the Tribune,
uh-huh.
But it was called Bay State Banner. And I worked for them for about 10 years or so. And then I worked for it's Oxfam America. It's a relief program. I worked for them about 4 or 5 years. And the mothers left me at home, and it was falling to pieces, so it was just time to get back and reconstruct.
The Harrison Avenue house?
No, it's one on Patton
Avenue.
Yeah, that's where I'm now. Been there about 20 years.
And that's the one she left you?
Yeah. She had 4 houses. Left everybody a house.
That's great.
Yeah.
Tell us about the schools that you attended here in Roanoke.
Well, here at Harrison, and then Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
There was only two at 10, I guess. And,
yeah.
I finished after I came back from the service. Because it was in the summer, I think. You had so many units you had to make up. Each subject was a half a unit. So I think you had to have 2 units each semester. You know, that means you had to take 4 subjects. And I think when I left, I just had only a unit to make up, you know. So it was in the summertime. We finished here in the summer, you know. Just a small class. And I got a bill ring from 1946. What's that, 60 years? And the funny thing about it was this was, you can't even see it's all worn down. But this was, I think it said 1945. And whoever finished at 45 pawned it. And so I got the ring and they, man, you know, he changed that five Thanks. Into a six. That's something. That's something. So actually, it was good. This was a big thing during those days, pawning things. You know, people were just poor. You know, you would pawn their winter clothes in the summer. You know, you have to get it out in the winter. Yeah, it was. A lot of us worked downtown. A lot of the stores were in town. Stein's and OPO and Oak Hall. No malls, so everything was in town. You know? And a lot of us worked there about $6 to $7 a week. But you could go out, it was like we go to Henry Street for, on a Sunday, $2, you know. And that's what you did, just dressed up. Or either they had dances down at the Runner Auditorium. You know, they wanted 85 cents. The big bands, all the big bands, too. And,
which ones do you remember?
Well, Duke Ellington came here, and Erskine Hawkins, and Benny Goodman, and just all the big bands you can think of during those days. And I remember they said they were making $25 a night, and the leader got $50. And they were traveling all over the country. When you look at these documentaries, you know, about these big bands, just remember that, you know, they were traveling, they were doing anything, but they weren't making, but, you know, stuff like that. I've seen someone go here and see, go across, you had a rummage sale, when it was just, they didn't stay overnight at Dumas, but they just stayed there to eat and to freshen up for it. I can go across, you want a rummage sale? Because they were just, once they finished playing, they would hop on the bus and go to another town. And Duke Ellington used to have a Pullman coach. And I know, you know, that's how he traveled. But I know once they didn't want to bring it up from North Carolina or something, he had to miss a game or something, because, you know, he was always eloquent, you know, with everything. But, that was basically, that's what he would either rent one or, you know, so the whole band could travel by train and not by bus. But it was exciting times, though, you know, it really was.
Kind of backing up a little bit, do you remember when you all got a telephone or a refrigerator or any of those things?
You always had to go down the street and ask somebody to use their telephone. You know? And we had the icebox. You know, you had a big sign you put on the outside, and it had four corners to it. You know, one would say 25, 50, 75, or 100, which lets the ice man know how many pounds of ice he wanted. And he'd bring it around and back, had this little rubber thing on his back, uh-huh. You know, so when he carried the ice, because he had the little tongs, just to pick the ice up. And sometimes it would be heavy, he had it around his back, you know. and it's so strange, if you refrigerate the ice box, and the biggest problem was make sure you change that water in the ice box, because the ice would trip me, and there's always one running over. You forgot about it. But it didn't hold much with the piece of ice. The ice in it didn't hold much. And you try to squeeze the watermelon in a bottle of milk in there. That's all you could get in there, you know. But that's what we used to keep things cold, you know. Yeah, and I can't even remember when we got the telephone. I don't even remember when we got a telephone. Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. But I do know we had the ice box. And the man would bring up most of the time it was 25 pounds. But we'd buy peaches, you know, by the bushel. And so one would can sell them for this. Yeah. I had to get two bushels. We'd be eating one while she tied the can. But, and it made, my aunt made a dandelion wine, you know, because we used to pick dandelions. I look at these dandelions, I said, they're just going to waste. We used to pick dandelions, you know, in a little gallon bucket that you got, lard can, that you got the lard in it. And we would pick, and people would pay us for that and make dandelion wine.
Did you all have a garden?
I don't think so. My granddad had two horses. And he did plowing. He went out and did plowing at the field. I think he plowed fields where people grew their corn. I don't remember. I know we had chickens.
In your yard?
Yeah. And my brother raised rabbits. I wouldn't be able to watch him kill one now. He raised rabbits in there. And we had, and then we all had the pets, you know, the guinea pigs and stuff like that. But,
do you remember some of the stories that were passed down in your family from one generation to another? Any you could tell us?
I can't really.
Any memories of the Civil War or before that or Reconstruction or anything at all?
I don't know whether Longwood would have been the one to know more about. But it's just probably going back before our time and how they had to survive, you know, basically. But I can't remember offhand of them saying it. I know we have talked about, you know, when she was coming up as a little girl and stuff like that. But, because I think she was teaching somewhere down south. I forgot now where it is. There's some things on paper somewhere I have to look up again.
And tell us about your military service, when it was and where you went. You told us a little bit.
Yeah, that was in 43. Yeah, I think it was 43. Yeah. So it was 18. I think first we went to Maryland. They call it a staging area. Then we went to Louisiana. Then we went to Liverpool, I think it was England. I think it was about 11 days crossing it, across the Atlantic. And then the thing about it was an English ship, Britannica, I think. It was an English ship, and they boiled everything. The whole troop got sick with the way they cooked, you know what I mean? But, and then, of course, it was a little tight, too, because that was the Germans had U-boats and stuff like that. So we, as the whole convoy went, you had a lot of air protection. And then after we left there, we went to France. A little after D-Day, I went to France, and we stayed there until Pearl Harbor hit. Well, actually, we were going to the Pacific, because they had planned to try to invade Japan, rather than, but they figured there was enough casualties in invading France, because thousands, the beach was just red with blood. And so I guess, and of course this was an occupied country, France was, not the enemy's country, so to speak. Whereas if you were enough cash was there, well, if you tried to invade Japan, you know, it would have been a massacre, you know, they were well protected. So, we were ready to go to France. After war ended in Europe, we were going to the Pacific. But it just happened to end, and we were at the Mediterranean, coming, because we were going through the Panama Canal, to go to the Pacific. But we were in the Mediterranean coming that way to make, and so we just happened to all ended while we were making that approach. So they figured, you know, the government did something smart once. But they figured it'd be cheaper to just let us come on home than to go, you know. So we just happened to be some of the first soldiers to return, you know. But the little $10 suitcase I had, made out of cardboard. But I lost a lot of good things because we thought we were going all the way back to Louisiana, you know. And so all of our duffel bags, and it went there too. And because I had collected water from the Atlantic Ocean, from the English Channel, and all those places. And a lot of guys had gotten some of the German guns and stuff. And so a lot of that stuff was lost. We never got back to it. Take me back home. Through the years. Yeah, we were in England, and then we went to France, and just went through Paris, you know. They were just, don't let them off here, we never find them again. We'll never find them again. They'll all go AWOL. But it was, because we had come, you know, after the invasion, St. No, citizens was just level, you know. Just one thing I heard that, which I wondered, that I think somebody had planned, I think even Hitler maybe had planned to, you know, to blow the Eiffel Tower and all that stuff, you know what I mean? And some general didn't follow the order, which for some, I think I was reading some history, because I always wondered why they didn't. When you're retreating, usually when you retreat, you know, you just blow up everything as you retreat, you know what I mean? So that was a fortunate thing that the Eiffel Tower and the Arc de Triomphe, they could have just, you know, they could have just blown that away. But somebody wanted to spare it. And then we just came back home there for a while. And then I started doing some studying. Well, you had a GI Bill of Rights, you know, which you could study. I think I studied everything shorthand. With the typing and shorthand, that's what went together. And bricklaying. Then I was going to music. I decided to go back to music. Man down, that was called Professor Gore. He was teaching. And I had seen this ad in a paper, in a Downbeat, I think it is, of a school in Boston. So I wrote to it. The thing about what was real ironic, I wrote to it. And they sent me this brochure. And it was one black fella in that whole brochure listening to, had a band practice or something. So to apply, I had to go down to the VA office. This is where the Clientsville is now. I had to go down to the VA office. So the guy who was interviewing me, he said, you know, I had to get the approval of them because they would school, the Army would be, I mean, the government would be paying. So he looks in his book, he said, well, I see you can go to this school. You know, and so I was just, sometimes you think about what would have happened if certain things else happened in your life, if you did this or if this hadn't happened, you know. And it was so strange. He said, well, I guess if that picture hadn't been in there, he might have just assumed that, you know. So we wrote to the school, and it was approved. And then the second bombshell, it was, the GIBO was going to end that September. You know, we had it for about 5 years. That was 51, so I think it must be from 46 to 51. And it was to end that September. So when I got in school, when I went to school, it was like July or August. And they said the school was closed for the summer. And I said, well, I got to get in here, you know, when it's open again, it'll be too late. And so they just registered me anyway. to make sure that I was in there. And that was another, you know, quirk of fate. But it just, and I guess if I hadn't gone to school in Boston, I never would have gone back to here. So you never know what twists and turns happens in your life, you know, because of certain things. And then my children wouldn't be there. And it was some way, it was some way it wouldn't really have to happen. Wouldn't it be some way if I could just said, suppose I had never gone to college. You know what I mean? But life is supposed to be like it is.
Back here in Roanoke, what were some of the stores and businesses that you and your family went to?
Well, I think on every corner you had a grocery store. Usually they were Syrians. And because we had one on this corner and one across the street, Ferris. We used to call it Ferris. Ferris. That's what the I is. F-E-R-R-I-S. They were poor, man. They were really poor. I think he had a baby every year. And they, remember watching that flat, unleavened bread? Yeah, that they used to eat a lot. But this is the neighborhood store. Then my uncle had a store later on. But it usually was a store in everywhere. There was one down on 6 years, there was one up Loudon. I mean, there's just grocery stores in on every corner, just about. But then, of course, you went to town to really get what you needed. At least we used to go there on Saturday nights. And I always wondered why my mama bought me a wagon for Christmas. So I'd pull a wagon down on Saturday night. And what you bought things in pecks and bushels and pints. You know, it looked, you know, because it had those peck cans. And you didn't. The first time I heard something about spinach by the pound, I said, you know, you buy it by the bushel or by the gallon. But we used to go there, and mommy's going to the last thing. And like you had one of these gallon cans, and she bought a gallon of potatoes. If you had about two or three potatoes left over, it wasn't enough. So she would strategically be at places like that. She'd know it. Would you buy this? But it wouldn't be enough left over to make another sale, so he man would just put all that in. You know? Then you bought peanut butter out of a big can, and you scooped it up, you know, and little things like that.
Was that down on the market, Roanoke Market?
Yeah, down on the market.
And then would you all take it home on the wagon?
Yeah, she'd ride the bus home, and I'd put the wagon home. 5 cents.
A lot of food.
Yeah, well, it's about $1 too, you know. About $1 too. Yeah. Well, we had relatives out in Slate Hill too, which is just about Tanglewood now, and we used to go out there, and they had everything: hogs and chickens and guineas and all kinds of fruits and stuff. Because I used to walk out there, it was about 5 or 6 miles, and give the bus driver a handful of cherries. And he drive us back. Isn't that something? I don't know what he could probably been making, you know. Didn't cost us 5 cents to go out there. And then, you know, he just let us in, you know, we'd pick a whole thing of cherries, and he'd just get him a handful of cherries, and he'd tell us ride or something. Isn't that weird? You wonder what was he making, you know. Yeah, but I'd work with people making $11 a week, and they were taking care of their family. Right? It's just all about money now, you know. We don't really get any more. If a loaf of bread costs a dime then and it costs a dollar now, we'd rather have that dollar to buy that loaf of bread than to have the dime. It's the amount of money you have, it's not what it will do for you. I think that's what we're into now. But people give you 2 cents to go to the store or something. 15 cents to clean the snow. These kids bought 5 and 10 to clean the snow off. But you can't blame them too much because everything costs for them. Yeah, they have to pay $1.25 on the bus just like anybody else. I saw 2 kids going out to, I think it was that Crossroads. They must have had to pick up something for their mother, you know, like, I think it was a party or something, maybe the cups or something. Well, she had to pay $4.80 for them to go out and come back. $5 for them to go out and come back, you know, just to pick that up. So that's why everybody wants a car or something. But anyway, it was just things happening. But that's, or you can yeah, the story, the ghost of the stores is most of where you dealt.
The corner grocery?
Yeah, the corner grocery store. Mm-hmm. They had them in just like every corner.
Did you go to Henry Street very much?
Oh, yeah. Lived there. Yeah, but, you know, that was where you would go, you know, for the movies. Unless you went downtown to Ronald Theater, you go to Ronald Theater. You ran it back on Kirk, but you had to go up about 10 flights up in there to get to it. But, so the Ronald Theater, so Virginia Theater was the one we went to. About, I think the highest was 35 cents for the movie on Sunday. And, you could make the day with about a dollar. The 5 cent hot dogs, the 5 cent sodas, you know.
Uh-huh. Stuff like that, yeah. Did you have some favorite businesses on Henry Street?
Well, they had, mostly it was, there was two big restaurants, and they had two or three pool parlors, and the Mack and them at the hotel had the Barlow's, who had the Dumas, they had, I think they had an ice cream parlor, the Jack and Jill ice cream parlor, and mostly it was just hangouts, you know. And I think Wagstaff had his TV, later on when TV came. And the guys and them had a record shop. And basically, that was really, business was probably a pool party. You know, that was what people hang out. And the barbershops and pool parties. And the cab, some taxi fans, you know. And I think a couple of restaurants, but and then you came on down to here. I think later on they put the Star City up there, the dance hall, and Chiru moved up there a little later on, and another pool hall, I think barbershop, two to the other place.
Yeah. Did you go to the Gainesboro Library?
Oh yeah. It was me.
When you were little.
Yeah. And the Y, too. Yeah, right across the street. Yeah.
The old Y.
Yeah, we went to the Y a lot of times.
What do you remember about the library? Mrs. Lee, do you remember her?
Yeah, I remember that I went down there, I don't know how long ago, and we're going to get the complete book, the complete works of Shakespeare. Carla said, here it is, I still owe it. Complete works of Shakespeare. Hey, I just didn't know they just put one of them in there. That could be really complete work. But I think basically I was in the Y more than I was in the library. And then they had some of them in the street, I think that a boy's trouble on Henry Street.
Tell us about some of the people you looked up to in those years.
Well, I guess we talk more about the teachers and the ministers. Those are people I see.
Any in particular you remember?
I can't remember anybody in particular that I actually looked up to. No, I don't guess we ever thought about we were looking up to somebody, you know. I don't think you really... Unless it was somebody just a little older than you, not, you know, maybe like the older brother or something, you know, or one of their friends or something, you might. Because I used to copy them when those who knew a little bit about music, I would try to steal what they had played. You know. And plus, I think those who were in the same thing, photography, the looking up to was just trying to copy them, you know, more than a real admiration. So you got to realize you were, I guess you was in kind of a segregated situation where everybody was, I don't know whether you thought about looking up to anybody, you know, because during that time you probably had white movie stars, you know what I mean? This was, you know, and you were programmed more to to look up to people outside of your race, or, you know, well, maybe like the Rockefellers or something like this. But I never thought too much about, you know, you got the barbers and you got the ministers, you know, and I never even thought about looking up to him. You know what I mean? It never occurred that way.
What do you remember about the civil rights movement?
Well, I was in Baltimore at that time, and they were really carrying on. But there's been a lot of instances of racism, you know, while I was here, you know.
Can you tell us about something?
Well, I know one thing that I kind of resented. They had these young white salesmen downtown. And they would call Mother Esther, you know, they just call her by Esther, you know. And this always bothered me a little bit. And, I had a lot of white, you know, a lot of kids down at the hill there. And we just got along fine. We never did really think about, you know, the separation. We knew when we would go down the wrong theater, they'd go different theaters. But I had a little short little band here in the 40s, and it was two white guys and two black guys.
What was it called?
With this particular group, but the big band I had was called the Sharps and Flats, and one was called the Chromatics. But I know we would go to train station after we played, and they had to go on one side. You know, to the restaurant, and we'd go to the other side. And then I had this one guy who was Johnny Hayslip. He's gone now. And I had to hold him down because so much racism that he wanted, you know, he just wanted to show off. But, because I think we went to one place that, maybe his girlfriend, who's white, you know, and when we taking a break, we all sitting in the same booth, and I know the managers didn't take too well to that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether, you know, it was just a general, when you grow up in it, it's so much part of your life, you know, that you don't think too much about it. Racism, this is overly done, you know, but you just, you know, they lived over there and we lived over here. I mean, it's just separate and you knew about them. But we had a lot of, well, one thing, they were more welcome here over here than we were there, because I know of the place called Elks Club. We used to go up to Elks Club with this white guy. And there were a lot of things going on, you know. There was a lot of mixture there. The feeling of togetherness, you know, between the races was much better than the actuality of it. Because everybody's just been, even white people been programmed, you know, and so were we. But we didn't experience any real, like in the deep south, I don't think.
How
did the run seem to
you when you came back? You came back much later, but it seemed like you changed.
No. You know, except for the physical change, you know, of the city. But I don't know. And of course, there's a lot of advances, you know. I mean, you had black mayor, and you got black people on the city. I think they used to appoint somebody. I didn't remember C.C. Williams' wife. But I think back in my days, they didn't have that particular election for people to sit again. It was a tokenism thing. They would make sure they had one black on it. And so they didn't really ask you. Worked that hard to be on there because they just knew it was going to be a, you know, token thing. But that's about it. Well, that's a big change because now, you know, it was because of integration, but to see all these people in high offices, you know, I mean, you got police chief and you got all that type of stuff, you know what I mean? So that makes a big difference.
And you saw Gainsborough change a lot after urban renewal.
Oh, yeah, from the Northeast? Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I used to work for the rental houses, and that was, yeah, just a lot of changes. Everything is gone. It's totally gone. And, but I don't say that it was, you know, really all that bad, because some of the areas were pretty bad areas anyway because of the poverty level of people. You know. But, and some of them, you know, have moved on, which makes it better. But, yeah, that was a big sweep to do that. And then the highway coming through and all of this, you know. And there has just been fussing about something all along, but just change has to come, you know.
Well, you were probably coming back to visit from Boston.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You would see it every
yeah,
time.
Yeah, you could see it, yeah. You could see the change. Especially on industry, you could just see the changes, you know. Little by little, the buildings fell to pieces, you know, stuff like that. And you could see the change. But it's a new day. That's what it is. It's just a new day. And we couldn't expect to be the same thing going on. What's going on over there?
Well, that sounds... Anything else you
want to
tell us? Anything at all?
I'll whisper to you. No, you just said one thing. I kind of hope that they will just bury Henry Street. You know, you can't revive something that during that time there was no TV, no... very few people had cars, it was segregated, you couldn't go anywhere else, it's just, I mean, and now the young people are just not the type of young people as we were young people, you know, 15 and a half, got to have a car, you know, things like this, so that's why I wish we would just bury it, you know, and go on and let it go, rather than feel that somebody's taken something from it. It's just time has taken what, you know, time has changed things. It's just, I heard once they're going to make these space stations and someday there'll be interstellar travel and all that. But as human beings, will we be any better? You know, with all the progress and all the electronics and all the convenience and all that, we still just not the, you know, people still got their problems and you know, so we got to do some changing on the inside, you know, just to kind of run from it. Anyway, c'est la vie, as they say, c'est la vie.
Thank you.
All righty.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Wonderful. Well, I could listen to you for next week.
So much has happened.
There's so many.